Welcome to the Institute of Leadership and Management's weekly podcast, where we critically review some topical developments with a leadership and management theme. I'm business and finance journalist Matt Packer, and in this podcast we'll be exploring stories up to Friday the 14th of September. Joining me in this endeavour is the Institute's Head of Research Policy and Standards, Kate Cooper. Hello, Kate.
Hello, Matt.
Okay, well, in our first story, former Barclays boss Bob Diamond has made a surprise return to the news agenda, telling the BBC's Simon Jack that banks are too constrained in their approach to risk. In the interview, Diamond says, quote, "If they are totally without risk, they are not helping to create jobs and economic growth. The culture of banking now is that if anyone makes a mistake, they get fined or the bank is in trouble," close quote. His thoughts emerged a week after IMF Managing Director Christine Lagarde published a blog to mark the 10th anniversary of Lehman Brothers' collapse, in which she argued, quote, "The financial sector still puts profit now over long-range prudence," close quote. What's your take?
Well, I think it really depends on what you think banking is for. And we tend to use banking as a description for all things that happen in banks. And of course, investment banking, which is where Bob Diamond comes from, is looking for big profits in global markets. And to get big profits in global markets, you're going to be taking big risks, because, of course, the reward for risk is big profits. Similarly, the reward for too much risk is big losses. Whereas, especially here in the UK, we hear so much about banks at a local level. And then I think this is where I would disagree slightly with the extent to which Bob Diamond thinks banking's helping the economy. Because at branch level, we hear continually that small businesses are being rated as too risky. The sort of security that they have to put up for loans is very stringent. And of course, small businesses are so important to the UK economy. And if they're being starved of funds to grow, then we're not going to see economic growth and prosperity, the sort that Bob Diamond is talking about. And if you think of a reward per head, the people that are making huge risks in global markets, so very few people. I don't know what employment he thinks that they're creating at that level. So that would be interesting to explore. But what I really would encourage us to think about at a local level is that if we are being too risk averse, then of course we're not going to get any rewards at all. So in that way, he's making a very important point.
I mean, something that strikes me as interesting about this story is that Bob Diamond can't exactly be described as a sort of poster child for the banking industry, because he left the bank under a cloud.
I think the only useful thing, or the lucky thing for him in a way, is that some people actually behaved even worse.
Yes, indeed. All right, in our second story, a major new report from the TUC suggests that the working week could do with a trim so that workers can benefit from the impact of new technologies. Announcing the report, called A Future That Works for Working People, TUC General Secretary Francis O'Grady said, quote, "Workers are having a hard time. They've suffered the longest pay squeeze in 200 years. Millions of people are stuck in insecure jobs and stressed out. Working people deserve their fair share, and that means more time with their families," close quote. She notes that workers who contributed to the report's findings would prefer a four-day week. Is this a plausible thing to wish for?
Well, I think if we look back over time and we look to the first industrialisation of Manchester, the hours that people were working there were huge. You know, Saturday working was normal. You know, working week has contracted and continued to contract because that's what history would suggest is going to happen. And it has been technology that has enabled us to maintain levels of productivity and income and economic growth, and at the same time have fewer human hours contributing to that. It's so difficult to see how one manages it in the short and immediate term, because you're setting a new benchmark. So it's taking the long view, knowing it's, I think, without doubt going to happen, and thinking very carefully about how we manage that on the way there. But I think when you come to low-paid workers on minimum wages, to them a four-day week, I assume, would seem an absolute disaster. And if you're part of the gig economy and you're being paid by the hour, I don't suppose you'd find that an attractive proposition at all. So they have to be taken into account as well, because it's no good giving all your salary staff a 4-day week and then having to pick up portfolio workers and people on 0-hour contracts. And then that gives another set of problems. This is going to be for years and years before we sort this one out. And it would be very interesting to go back and if the records exist in how organisations did manage the stopping of Saturday morning working, or when they have reduced working weeks, what was the lived experience of the people who were managing it then?
And what were the logistical processes that they went through to be able to factor it in?
Yes.
Yes, indeed. Well, next up, we have a story in a very similar vein, with the Royal Society of Arts saying that now we have job quantity relatively under control, it's time to focus on quality. In a new report, the charity proposes a set of new measurements for potential inclusion in the UK labour force survey that it says will build up a more detailed picture of the quality of people's jobs. The measurements fall under umbrella headings such as pay and benefits, job design and social support and cohesion. The report is a sequel of sorts to last year's Taylor Review, which was led by RSA Chief Executive Matthew Taylor, who said, quote, "We do not know whether workers feel happy, well treated, have opportunities for progression, work the number of hours they want to, or feel they have control over their working lives," close quote. Will these new metrics help?
Well, I think we do know the answers to some of those questions, and we've certainly known them since the 1950s when Hertzberg laid it out really quite clearly for us. And because we still talk about Hertzberg's motivators and hygiene factors, there must be something about them that resonates and suggests it's a good representation of the working experience of a lot of people. We've also got engagement figures that show that people, on the whole, are not engaged with the work they do. The majority don't get a huge amount of satisfaction from their work. Mm. And studies that are undertaken tell us that people like a degree of control. They like a degree of flexibility over how they can work. They like to be recognised and appropriately rewarded for what they consider to be their effort. So there's a set of researchers saying we want work to be like this, but they're not the people who are going to make it happen. And we find that so often with so many initiatives. It's the line manager, the people that we represent at the Institute, who are being told by so many different lobbying groups, you've got to be aware of people's mental health at work. You've got to ensure that there's learning transfer when they go on training programmes. You've now got to ensure that people are coached rather than directed at work. You've got to mediate instead of using traditional grievance procedures. And this all falls to the line manager, who not only has their staff to keep happy, but they've also got their own job of work to do.
How do you think we can help line managers in that regard?
I think we can recognise how difficult a job managing people is. We can certainly help prepare them for that job. And we can also acknowledge that you should be able to advance in organisations and earn higher levels of reward and not actually have to manage people, if that isn't the sort of thing that appeals to you. But you can still make a valuable and important contribution. Since the 80s, we've been trying to take the role of the manager more seriously. But we've got nowhere near enough yet recognising the difficulty in training and developing people to assume those responsibilities. And as I say, in actually recognising that it's not for everybody.
Yes, indeed. All right, and finally, it's been a rough week for our four-legged friends, with Wetherspoons announcing that it is firmly banning dogs from its outlets with immediate effect. The chain notes that it has operated a soft ban on dogs since 1979, but the new measure will be much more strictly enforced. Spokesman Eddie Gershon said, quote, "Even well-behaved dogs can be unpredictable, plus younger children in particular can be unpredictable around dogs and many are scared of dogs," close quote. Assistance dogs will be exempt from the ban. Now, my question here is this a massive snub to dog-loving customers?
Why is it they don't want dogs in their pubs? Because I remember speaking to an environmental health inspector not so long ago, and she was saying in terms of the hygiene, young children present far more a health hazard than do dogs.
Well, that's very interesting.
It is. I think, speaking from my own personal experience, I don't think I've seen a badly behaved dog in a pub.
No.
And I just wonder what this is really about. Of course, there are some people who do not like dogs and really do not want to spend their leisure time with dogs. But to have a ban in all their pubs, surely we can now find registers of dog-friendly hotels throughout Europe. There are apps called Take Fido.
Yeah, I mean, it's strange because they don't have music in their pubs. So if music is gone and dogs are gone, maybe people won't go.
Well, the music used to be, pubs didn't have music. And there were quite a few old landlords holding out against it, weren't there? And they're the traditional pubs without music. And then it seemed to become that every pub had music. But the old traditional pubs certainly had dogs in them.
Well, we shall see how that turns out. Okay, that concludes this episode. Listeners can find further topical content in the News and Views section of the Institute's website, which can be found at www.institutelm.com. That's www.institutelm.com. As they say on TV, this is the last podcast in the current series. Thank you very much for listening, and thank you, Kate, for all of your insights.
Thanks very much, Matt.